2,000 years ago, the creator of the universe made an everlasting covenant with Abraham. All the land, from the Euphrates to the Nile, belongs to the sons of Israel. Shock waves will shake the earth as heaven reaches down to fulfill that promise. Every nation that attempts to interfere with that covenant will march onto the battlefield against the Almighty. Prepare for a rude awakening.
The teaching I'm going to share with you today really was one that came by inspiration. Some of you that were here were with me in Israel and may have heard part of this teaching that we'll do today, and part of it will be tomorrow. So a section of this teaching came was led by really the inspiration of the Spirit when we were on the last tour in Israel this spring. We had a lot of people that were new to the concepts of the Torah and new to the Messianic movement and what we were trying to teach. And Michael and I kind of realized that there was just a lot of people staring at us, you know, just, and we were missing it. We were trying to communicate, but we were speaking, but they weren't able to hear it. And so I went back, and after the first night of teaching, we prayed, and it just kind of rolled out. And so you're going to be the recipient of part of that teaching tonight. And there's when I came back from Israel, the Lord showed me the beginning and the end of the teaching. So we started in the middle, and then we've expanded it. But we're going to try to get through, in the limited time we have, through the whole thing today. Now, one of the realities of Torah, and you've heard Michael and I both refer to leaven free Torah, and that is that the Torah largely has been passed down, and the scriptures have been passed down to us. But in the process of that, there's a lot of things get twisted, turned, and changed. And so it started to dawn on me that the Torah in many ways is like a river. And the further that river gets from its source, as it passes through the stream bed and the river bed, it picks up silt, it picks up pollution, it picks up various things along the way that become part of the river. And so the people that are downstream, when they receive the water, it looks different. Now, I shared with you before, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, one of the things it's known for is the three rivers. There's the Monongahela River, the Allegheny River, and they form the Ohio River. And so these three rivers come together in a valley. And if you go up on the top of the river, it was kind of interesting when I was growing up because all the steel mills were very active there. And the Allegheny River came out of the mountains of the Allegheny Forest. But the Monongahela River was the river that all the steel mills were on and all the coal mines. And so that's where all the barges were, all the industry was. And if you stood up on top of Mount Washington, it's called, if you stood up on top of Mount Washington and looked down at the confluence, the place where the three rivers come together, you would quickly see how colorful it was. Because the Allegheny River came down a very pretty shade of blue. The Monongahela River came up a very peculiar shade of brown. Then they make the Ohio, and for the first 100 yards or so of the Ohio River, the southern bank is brown and the northern bank is blue until the water finally mixes. Now, that water ultimately ends up in the Mississippi River, and if you go to the Mississippi River, what's the nickname of the Mississippi River? The Big Muddy. Yeah, it's just muddy. Well, some of that stuff comes from Pittsburgh, or at least it did. All right. So we see that as that river goes, it's picking up more and more and more till the end product is very different than the beginning. Now, what our heart is and what our goal has been is try to get you some good water. You know, that's my dad used to joke about in the mill concerning the water. He said, you know, well, if Jesus was in Pittsburgh, it wouldn't be hard to walk across that river. That water's thick. We would like to give you clean, refreshing water, not thick water. So our heart is trying to go back to the source, get to the spring, get to the place where the river starts, because there it's not had a chance to be defiled and polluted. And so that's what we're going to do. We call this teaching the Path of Pure Torah. And to really understand this, I want you to see that in the Torah itself, in the scriptures, there's a connection between the use of the word water and the word. In other words, water is oftentimes allegorical. It's used as a metaphor for the word itself. And so let's just look at a couple examples there. Let me just read these to you. Isaiah chapter 55, verses 1 and 3. And it's subtle at first, but so just listen hearty. Isaiah writes, "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, cometh ye to the waters. And he that hath no money, come you buy and eat. Yea, come buy wine and milk without money and without price. Wherefore do you spend money for that which is not bread? And your labor for that which satisfieth not. Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear, and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David." Now, he begins by drawing our attention to the reality that people are thirsty. And then he invites them to come to the water. But how do they drink? With their ears. Hearken, listen, give me your ear, and you will be satisfied. The prophet Jeremiah, chapter 2, verse 13. "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and they have hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water." Jeremiah 10:13, "When he uttereth his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heaven, and he causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasures." Proverbs 18:4, "The words of a man's mouth are as deep waters, and the wellspring of wisdom as a flowing brook." Proverbs 25:25, As cold waters to a thirsty soul, so is good news from a far country. Ephesians 5:25-27, "Husbands, love your wives, even as Messiah also loved the assembly of believers and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious assembly, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish." Now, we can say that this is about the word of Yahweh, but I want you to see that water is also sometimes connected to the word of man and to the nations and to the voices of the nations. Psalm 18:16, he says, "He sent from above, he took me, he drew me out of many waters." Psalm 144:7, "Send thine hand from above, rid me and deliver me out of great waters from the hand of strange children." Isaiah 17:12, "Woe to the multitude of many people, which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and of the rushing of nations, that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters." Revelation 17:15, "And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues." Revelations 19:6, "And I heard as it were the voice of a great multitude, and as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a mighty thundering, saying, Hallelujah, for Yahweh Elohim omnipotent reigneth." In many ways, the whole story of the Bible is the story of two waters. Or better said, the story of two words. On one hand is the water, or the word of Yahweh. And on the other hand is the water, or word of man. Now, many of the teachings included in the Torah, and even the life and ministry of Messiah, are rooted in the tension that's created by the mixing of these two waters. Now, we already talked about that a little bit. For those of you who were at the Torah portion earlier, I talked about that jumbut, that quagmire, and that pattern that runs all through the Torah of there being a quagmire or a mixture. Then Yahweh makes distinctions. Then he calls someone out to solve that, a righteous one to separate things. And that pattern goes on and on. So there's this tension that exists between the will of the Creator to create order and to bring things out to its purity, and it seems the supposed will of man to do the exact opposite, to bring it back into just quagmire and mixture. In his book, Christ the Center, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran theologian during World War II, who was martyred in a concentration camp for being a part of a plot to assassinate Hitler. He wrote a book called Christ the Center. And in that book, he caught this vision of the two words at battle with one another. And he said, Yahweh created man with one mouth, and therefore only one word can be spoken at a time. And for one word to be spoken, the other word must be silent. He described the whole passion and crucifixion of the Messiah as being simply the will of man to silence once and for all the word of Yahweh. On the other hand, he saw the resurrection as Yahweh getting the last word. He's a big God to argue with. We all currently live in a world that's filled with many words, some of them our own. And these words are often at conflict with one another. We have Republicans fighting Democrats, the Protestants fighting the Catholics, the Baptists against the Charismatics, the Messianics, we're against everybody. We've got Arabs and Jews, and I mean, just there's all these words being shouted out there, wanting to be heard, demanding our allegiance, demanding our attention. And in that great cacophony of words that are being plastered on the TV and on the radio and in the magazines we read and on the internet and all these words that are swirling around us like a big quagmire, a big jumbut, there is but one word that is not mixture. And there is one word that is not polluted. And there is one word that are the words of life. And those are the words of Yahweh, the creator of heaven and earth. So for us to look at this and try to get upstream, if you will, I mean, how many of you feel like since you got into this motion, you've been walking against the current? Anybody else feel that? Like you're going, you know, a fish swimming upstream. Well, that's exactly what you're doing. How are you doing that? By the power of the Spirit. It's leading you upstream so that you can get out of the pollution and get to the pure water that brings forth life. That's what we want. We don't want to be swimming down there with the carp and the Monongahela. We want to be upstream. Now, let's go back right to the very beginning then, and we're going to start this journey, and we're going to look at this history, this path of Torah as it begins in the garden, and hopefully if there's time, we're going to get all the way to the end with the second coming of the Messiah, and we're going to look at this connection, and I want you to see, because we're not only going to be talking about the history of the Word, we're going to be talking about the history of the people of the Word, and the history of the creator and speaker and author of the Word, and how these things, like a river, are all twined together. But there's a pure stream in there, and that's the stream we have to be in. The Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1, says this. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was Elohim. The same was in the beginning with Elohim, and all things were made by Him. And without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life. And the life was the light of men. Now here we see the word of Elohim was present from the beginning. 10 times in the story of creation and the opening chapters of the book of Bereshit or Genesis, 10 times we see the words and read the words, and Elohim said. He spoke and things came into being. Now, recognizing the connection between water and word, we should not be surprised that the world that He created was covered with what? Water. It was all covered with water. So right from the beginning, we're already seeing a connection between the word of the Creator and the water. But it tells us in the book of Genesis and the first two chapters that in the beginning Elohim created the heavens and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of Elohim moved upon that quagmire, upon the waters, and He began making distinctions. He began calling things out. And the first distinction that we see that the Creator makes, naturally, is light. He had to see what He was doing. So He creates light, and He separates the light out of the darkness. He didn't want to walk around in all that mud. All right? So He creates light out of the darkness. The very second thing He does after he creates light is that He divides the light from the darkness. And the next step of the creation process, in verses 6 and 8, it says, And Elohim said, Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Elohim made a firmament and divided the waters from the waters, from which the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And Elohim called the firmament heaven, and there was evening and morning a second day. Now, there's a lot of interesting things to see in this little passage. First off, he says he divided the waters from the waters. And there's waters above, waters below. The Hebrew word for heaven is shamayim. The word for water in Hebrew is mayim. So we see, even in the word, in the language itself, we see shamayim. There's water up there. All right? In the very word heaven, shamayim, is the word mayim, is the word water. All right? However, it also tells us, and we should see this, we talked about the cyclical nature of the Creator and His work among men. Well, here it is. Do you remember this story? It used to puzzle me a little bit. Here's Moses at the Red Sea. He's you know, just brought the people through the valley of Pihahiroth, the little gorge there, the mouth of the gorge. He comes out on the beach, right? He's standing at the Red Sea. The people look up and see Yul Brynner coming with all of his chariots, all right? They're barreling down on him. You can see the big cloud of dust from all the chariots. They're coming in, and the people realize, we don't have anywhere to go. We're caught between the sea in front of us and Pharaoh behind us, and there's you know, it's a gorge, so we can't climb the mountains. We're doomed. And the people begin crying out against Moses and saying, why did you do this? Why did you lead us here? Why didn't you take us north, the shortcut? Why did you make us come this way? We're going to all be destroyed. Is it because you hate us? And then it tells us that Moses cried out to the Lord. But the Lord rebukes Moses. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was in that situation and I went where the Lord told me to go and I got there and there was a big, you know, Lake Michigan in front of me, and then he said, you know, go this way, and the enemy was coming behind me, I would probably cry out. So he cries out. Now, the part that puzzled me is that the Lord rebuked him. And I thought, why? For years, why did the Lord rebuke him there? And what he says, Exodus 14, and Yahweh said unto Moses, wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. So it's like he has no patience with Moses here. And so that puzzled me. And then I started coming to this understanding and I realized something. Oh, man. There it was. In the story of creation, what's the second thing that Yahweh does? He divides the water. It shouldn't have been an issue. Anyone that knew that Elohim was the creator of the heavens and the earth knew that the second thing he revealed about himself, besides that he doesn't like to work in the dark, is that he can part water. So there was no reason for a lack of faith there. All right? Now, it's also interesting. I don't have my driver baseboard here, so you'll have to use your imagination. But the Hebrew word for water is spelled Mem, Yud, Mem. And if you take that back into those ancient pictures, the letter Mem is a picture of water. So what you see is a picture of water. Then the letter Yud, Yud is the Hebrew word for hand. And literally the picture is of a hand. And then it's followed by another picture of water. So literally in the word water, what you see is water with a hand and water. It's like the word itself depicts Yahweh separating the waters. He is dividing water from the water. Now, the thing we need to recognize in the story of creation is that he did, which is different than the Exodus. In the Exodus, he divided the waters what? Left to right or north and south. But in the story of creation, how does he divide it? Upper and lower. And that's significant. He divides the word of Yahweh from the word of man. He puts a distinction. And we're going to see that playing out now in the rest of the creation narrative, and especially with the creation of man. He separates the waters from above from the waters below. There's no confusion then between the word of Yahweh and the word of man. Remember we said our creator is a creator of distinctions. We need to learn this distinction. There is a difference between the word of Yahweh and the word of man. And we need to keep them separated. Now, let me address this connection here with the word of Yahweh and man in particular. Because we're going to see this issue of the upper realm and the lower realm really come into play in our very nature and our very character. And it'll maybe help some of you, it certainly has me, get a grip on myself so I understand what's going on and who I am and who I'm supposed to be listening to. The Gospel of John again. Isn't it nice when you can start a Torah study in the Gospels? Isn't that great? I love that. You know, it's like when you recognize it, then it's okay. You see it everywhere. Okay, John chapter 1, verse 14, the continuation of John's prologue to his Gospel. It says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Now, while we often limit this teaching and say, well, yeah, this verse 14, he's talking about Yeshua. And I agree 100%. He's talking about Yeshua. Well, we tend to have a tendency, though, to limit it to Yeshua. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that we should not. Because if you listen carefully to the creation story, Yahweh spoke and his words came into substance. He said, let there be something, and it was something. All right? In other words, all his words came to become flesh. They became corporal. They became tangible. They became real. So originally his word, we refer to it as the potential word. The creation began where? It began in the heart and the mind of the Creator. Let me just take a little rabbit trail here quickly. The first letter of the Torah is the letter Bet. All right? It's the second letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter Bet. And the picture is that of a little house. That's what the letter Bet is a picture of. And we may ask ourselves, wait a minute, if the Creator was going to write the Torah, why didn't he start with the letter Aleph? Why not begin with the first letter instead of the second letter? All right? I mean, it would just make sense that if you were going to start numbering something, you generally start with the number one. And so if you're going to have the first word of your book, you would think you would start with the first letter. But he doesn't. The Creator chose the second letter. And I'm going to give you real quick two reasons for that. First off is because he wants us to understand that when he begins to create things, he's creating a house. He's creating a dwelling place where he will dwell with his creation. So it's a beautiful, the first letter of the Torah scroll, if you wound that thing all the way back to Bereshit 1, you would see in that Torah scroll that the letter Bet is made bigger. And it's not made bigger just to be fancy in the text. It's not a capital letter. There's no upper or lower case in Hebrew. It's made bigger to get our attention and to tell us there's a lesson there. So from the very opening letter of the Torah, we learn that Yahweh's intention was to build his house, to take a bride, to build his house, and to dwell with man. Beautiful, beautiful beginning to a book. The question is, what happened to the letter Aleph then? Why not Aleph? Well, Aleph, what sound does the Aleph make? None. Aleph is a silent letter. So how do you begin speaking with a silent letter? You can't. So the Aleph, in its absence, in some sense, represents what I call the potential word. The Aleph is that word when, and Aleph is the word, the first letter of the word El, or Elohim. It's the first letter for the word God. In other words, the Aleph is Him. And the whole creation begins in Him, but until He speaks it, it's not real. It's potential. It's real in Him, but it's not real for us. So the Torah has to begin with the first letter that makes a sound, and that's the letter Bet. So what we see here is this potential word is in the mind and the heart of the Creator. It's in His will to create things, but when He speaks, He calls it into being, and now it becomes corporal. So in reality, the whole creation, everything that we can see, everything that we can feel, all of it is word become flesh. You understand what I'm saying there? Now, Yeshua, or man, really began with Adam. Adam becomes the absolute epitome of that. Shaul, writing to the Romans in 1st 1, kind of in a rebuke, is talking about those who have rejected the Lord and saying they are without excuse, speaks and says that everything that the Creator created, every word that came out of His mouth that became something, is an expression of His will. And therefore, it reveals something about Him. So just by mere creation alone, we can come to know who He is. Shaul writes, "Because that which may be known of Elohim is manifest in them, for the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and divine nature." In other words, because He spoke, whatever we're looking at, we can discern from that that it was obviously His will that this thing exists, and therefore it communicates to us a part of His character. Now, we also have to recognize that when the Word became flesh, it was for the purpose of making Him known. When He speaks, He's revealing Himself. So we know of our Creator that He has a desire to be known. He has a desire to commune. So how do we embody, if you will, the image of Yahweh in our lives? By exercising dominion over the lower realm and by being all about life. Now, again, this is important for us to understand because we recognize that in the creation of man, we have two natures going on. Where the Creator is one, we are not. We have two natures. We have a spiritual nature that allows us to commune with the Spirit of the Creator. It allows us to receive revelation. It allows us to hear His voice and to have intimacy with Him, to know Him and to be known by Him. That's the spiritual nature of man. It belongs to the upper realm, if you will. It draws us upward. It's the Spirit that wants to return to the Creator. It wants to be one with the Creator. And it draws us to that upper realm and motivates us from there. The spiritual nature is what gives our spirit man, or the Spirit of the Creator is what gives our spirit man its sustenance. And it's where the Word of Yahweh communicates to us. Now, in order for us to communicate these revelations in the tangible world, we have to have a corporal nature as well. We're going to have a physical nature, and that belongs to the lower realm. We share this corporal nature, in fact, with the animals. That's where we're just like them. They have bodies, we have bodies. They have appetites, we have appetites. They have lusts and desires and instincts, you know what? We do too. So in that regard, we're the same as the animal realm, the lower nature. All right, we share that in common, and so we can play this unique role of being a mediator. Some religions, such as Gnosticism and Stoicism and Asceticism, they teach that man is supposed to get rid of his flesh, be free from his flesh, and become just pure spiritual being and float off. Well, that's wonderful, but you're not serving the calling you were created for. So that whole notion that developed kind of in the Middle Ages and later of our flesh being evil and our flesh being filthy and dirty and, oh, we've got to get rid of our flesh. That's not from the Torah. We were created to have flesh. Yahweh gave us the flesh. He gave us the appetites. He gave us our senses. He gave us our feelings and our emotions. All those things come as a way for us to protect our bodies. If you don't eat, you die. So He gives us hunger pains to remind us to eat and take care of our flesh. Yahweh created us to have flesh. Now, since we have both of these natures, we have the upper nature and the lower nature, we have a spiritual nature and a flesh nature or animal nature, we can play this unique role of mediator because we can stand as in our flesh and call out to the Creator and ask for His help, His guidance, His mercy, His direction. We can intercede for the rest of creation, including other human beings. We can cry out in prayer to Him and intercede and stand before the Creator in our spirit man and intercede for the rest of the world, the corporal world. But because we're a spirit man, because we have spiritual nature, we can also receive revelation from the Creator and then stand with the Creator and speak to the rest of creation. That's the Melchizedek priesthood. All right, do you understand what I'm saying here? The Melchizedek priesthood is the original priesthood of all mankind. It was the priesthood before the fall. It's the priesthood of perfect man living in perfect order, ministering as the mediator between the invisible Creator and the visible world. Yeshua, the Mashiach, He is the Kohen Gadol of that. The Aaronic priesthood and the Levites, they're the shadow picture. They're the object lesson to teach us how to do it. But this greater body ministry is the ministry of the Melchizedek priesthood. It's that mediator between the two realms, or because of the two realms. Now, Sheol gives us phenomenal warnings, and I'm just going to quote one passage, but 6, 7, and 8 of Romans. He goes through and talks about the dilemma that's caused because of these two natures. In Romans chapter 8, verse 5 and 8, it says, "For they that are after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh, but they that are after the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is an enmity against Elohim, for it is not subject to the law of Elohim, neither indeed can it be. So then, they that are in the flesh cannot please Elohim." Sheol goes on to say that those who are carnally minded can't receive the revelation of Yahweh. Why? Because He doesn't speak to us in our flesh. He speaks to us in the Spirit.
So you have to be spiritually minded to understand the revelations of Yahweh. And here we see this tension that begins to grow because of the fall, and we'll talk about that in a minute, between these two natures. One is drawing us upward, the other is drawing us downward. Our soul is crying out and thirsting for the pure water of the Word, and our flesh is hungering for a Big Mac. All right? And it's drawing us. Which way do we go? Which way do we go? You can see with me which way usually wins. All right. Now, while man is made up of two natures, he's still a tripart being. Okay? So we have an upper nature and a lower nature, but really, when these two natures collide, there's a middle element. And so we see that man is made up in a tripart being. The spirit of man is that part capable of communing with the Creator and receiving revelation knowledge. The flesh is that part of man which is capable of interaction with the corporal world around him and communing with other creatures. And in between those two is the soul. And the soul is what makes you and I, you and I. It's what makes us different from each other. The soul is the seat of man's emotions, his intellect, his will, and his personality. Now, when Yahweh created man, he created him in a specific order. And the spirit is to receive knowledge from the Creator. Then the spirit of man is to communicate with the soul of man and tell the intellect and the will and the emotions how to feel, how to think about things, how to make decisions. And then the soul is to inform the flesh, this is how you act. All right? So this beautiful created order. The spirit of Elohim communicates to the spirit of man. The spirit of man talks to the soul of man, tells them how to view things, how to see things. All right? That's why in the Garden of Eden, when they were both naked, they weren't ashamed. It's because they were both in the proper order, and there was nothing to be ashamed of. The soul didn't tell Adam to look at his wife lustfully. It said, look at her like your helpmate. And so there was no shame there. But when his eyes were open, something different happens. Now, so we see this whole order of things. The spirit of the Creator reigns over the spirit of man. The spirit of man reigns over the soul of man. The soul of man reigns over his flesh. That's exercising dominion. Do you understand that? And if the flesh is the lower realm, then man is manifesting the image of Yahweh by exercising that reign, that dominion, the spirit of the Creator, the spirit of man, the soul of man, over the lower realm. So as long as we're exercising dominion over our animal nature, then and listening to the spirit of the Creator, then we're manifesting the image of Yahweh. And we're going to be all about life. Now, this is perfect man, living in perfect order. And that perfect man in perfect order was placed in a garden. And guess what was in the garden? Two trees. Isn't this wild? We have all these twos coming up. Are you paying attention to that? A little theme running through here. So we have two trees in the garden. And one of the trees is the tree of life. And the other one is the tree of knowledge and good and evil. Now, when Yahweh created things, if we read that whole narrative, and we don't have time to do that, so I'm rushing through this a little bit. You're going to see that when Yahweh created things, he made distinctions. So he said, okay, you be a chicken. And there was chicken. And chickens give birth to chickens. They don't evolve into monkeys and dinosaurs. They become chickens. All right? They're in perfect order. Everything brought forth after its kind. Dogs begat dogs, cats begat cats, apple trees brought forth apples, cherry trees brought forth cherries, pomegranate trees brought forth pomegranates. Everything was copacetic in the garden. Everything brings forth according to the distinctions and the judgments that Yahweh made. There is only one tree in that garden mentioned that is of mixed seed. And that is the tree of knowledge of good and something else. It's interesting, isn't it, that of all the trees, he said, you are free to eat of all the trees in the garden, except this one that is made of mixed seed. It's something and something else. And it'll bring forth after its kind, too. It's going to bring forth mixture. But notice that's the prohibition. Now, some people think it was cruel of Yahweh. Well, if he knows everything, he knew Adam was going to fall. Why would he put something there to make him stumble? He didn't put it there to make him stumble. Yahweh created man so that man would love him. He calls man to love him just as he loves mankind. And so for love to be love, it has to be freely given, correct? I mean, it's like, you know, with my little children when they're fighting with each other, when the boys are fighting with each other and you make them apologize, you know, and they really, like, aren't over it yet. They're still angry. And you say, no, apologize, shake hands. Fine. You know, that's not love. Say something, oh, you hug each other. And they hug each other. The next one, ow, he squeezed me. And the fight starts all over again. All right? It's not love. For love to be love, it has to be freely given. In order for it to be freely given, it has to be what? A choice. There has to be a choice to give or not to give. The two trees in the Garden of Eden are that choice. Yahweh didn't give them to Adam and Eve to trip them up and cause them to stumble. He gave them as a means of worship. How do we show an invisible being that we love him? Obedience to his word. It's all through the scripture. If you love me, keep my commandments, right? So the best way of showing love was to have a commandment, a prohibition. And every time Adam and Hava walked past that tree and did not eat, because Yahweh said, do not eat of it, they demonstrated their love and worship and declared to Yahweh, you are worth more to me than anything that old maggot-infested, termite-infested tree could ever offer me. I don't want what it can offer me, because you are my delight. So every time they obeyed that commandment, they sang their praise to Yahweh, and they demonstrated their free love of him. Does that make sense to you? It wasn't there to trip them up. It was there to give them opportunity to praise the Lord and to worship him and to love him. Now, I think these two trees also serve to represent the two natures. And that's really what's going on in the garden. The tree of life represents living in the upper realm. It represents living in perfect order. It's where we go and we live in our spirit. We're drawn up and we just love communing with the source of life. And we go there and we commune with him and we just let him reign over us. That's the tree of eating of the tree of life. It's going to the source of life and just feasting on his beauty, of his holiness, and on his grace, on his mercies. And so to live by the tree of life, to eat and be sustained by the tree of life, means that we are living by the exclusive revelation of Yahweh. We are going to put ourselves in a place where we are completely dependent for all our knowledge on the Creator of all life. That's what it means to eat of the tree of life, to live exclusively by the upper waters, by the upper word. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is something different. It's mixture. And what does it represent? It represents living life like most of us live our lives. A little bit by the word of God and a lot by our own word. In other words, living by the tree of the knowledge of good and evil means that to eat of that fruit is to do exactly what the serpent in the story tells Adam and Hava will happen. Your sensual eyes will be opened. Your physical senses will come alive. And they are going to start feeling things and sensing things and seeing things and hearing things and smelling things. And your spirit is going to be telling your soul, look this way, Adam. Feel this way. And your senses are going to be saying, no. Whew, feels good. Feels good. And you're going to have this battle going on between the two natures. One saying, give me the Big Mac. And the other one saying, no, fast and pray. And this battle's going on. Now, if you start living, what happens to you? You've got to make a decision at that point. And the moment you start making a decision between the word of Yahweh and the word of your own flesh or the word of man, you become Elohim. And that's exactly what the serpent tells them. If you eat of this tree, your eyes will be open and you will become, it says in the King James, like God. Or in some translations, it'll say like gods. But the Hebrew word is the word for Elohim. You have to understand that the Hebrew word Elohim does not mean God. It means authority. And so we declare Yahweh is our Elohim, or Shema Yisrael, Yahweh is our Elohim, Yahweh is one. We're saying our authority is Yahweh. All right, that's what we're declaring there. So other people have many Elohim. They have many authorities. They have mixture of authorities. We have one authority. So we confess with our mouths. All right? So what we're seeing here is that when the serpent says to Adam and Hava, you'll become your own authority. And your eyes will be open and you will become like authorities. And so what do? We go and we read the Bible and we pray and the Lord speaks into our hearts and he says to do something foolish, like leave your country, leave your kindred folk, and leave your household. And we say to ourselves, let me think about that. doesn't sound reasonable to me. I think maybe what I'll do is just go away on vacation for a little while. Get away for a bit. Maybe that's what the Lord's telling me, you know. Head to Bermuda, have a nice cruise, then I'll come back. That sounds better. And instantly now we've got this war going on between the two waters, between the two words, between the two realms, between the two seeds, between the two trees. All right, as soon as we have two, we have division. And so what happens here, recognize that a lot of people like to say to the story that it was the serpent is the devil or Satan. I don't like that. I like to say he's a serpent. What is a serpent? It's an animal. Who were we supposed to have dominion over? The animal. The whole point of the story in my mind, and there's many points to this story, but in my mind the biggest point of this story is that Adam and Hawa were called to exercise dominion over the animal nature, over the lower realm. And instead, they submitted themselves and listened to the animal realm, and it caused them to mix their word with Yahweh's word. And from that point on, there is war in the garden. Now, again, what do we see here? It's mixture. And so he is thrown out. We are called by the Torah not to add or subtract to the word. Yahweh does not like mixture. He likes purity. He likes holiness. He likes his word standing out alone. He shares his glory with no one. And so we have to be willing, as the creatures, we were called to submit ourselves to the exclusive word. But the fruit of the fall of Adam and Hawa is evident in the fruit they bear. Adam and Hawa, it says in the very next chapter, chapter 4 of the book of Genesis, that Adam and Hawa, that Adam knew Hawa. It's like, right, she was a stranger to him all these days? There's only two people on the face of the earth. Come on. Adam knew her. Man, he had intimacy with her. And they produced fruit. They're twins, Cain and Abel. But are they twins? Are they identical twins? No. Absolutely not. What are they? Mixed seed. The point of this story is to contrast their characters. It tells us that there was a point in time where the two of them bring forth an offering. And a lot of times people say, well, they made a sacrifice, and this is, you know, Abel made a blood sacrifice, and Yahweh accepted it because it was a blood sacrifice. I'm going to refute that. On the basis of the words of the Torah itself in Hebrew, it doesn't ever say the word sacrifice. It says they brought a minka offering. And if you read in the book of Leviticus later on, you'll find out that the minka offering is always a bloodless offering. So in other words, Abel brought the lambs, and in the way, again, some of the Bible translations said the fat of the lambs. It doesn't say that. It said the fat ones of the lambs, meaning that he not only brought his first fruit, but he looked at over his flock and said, this is the best one. That's what I'm giving to the Creator. He is worthy of my best. And so he brought not only the first fruits of his fold, but he also brought the best of his fold. And that's what he presented and consecrated to the Lord. It doesn't say he sacrificed it. Again, it says a minka offering. All right. Also, at this time, they weren't eating meat. Remember, they were still vegetarian diet, probably back then, at the time of Cain and Abel. So there wouldn't necessarily the animals would be consecrated for wool and used for holy purposes in that fashion. His brother Cain also comes, and he brings forth. It tells us in the Torah that Cain was a farmer, and he brings forth the fruit of the earth. Now, it's interesting because there's several words for earth in Hebrew. One of them is aretz. The other one is adama. And if you remember, Adam, it says, was created from the dust of the adama. It's a beautiful little wordplay there, that Adam comes from adama. It says here that Cain offered up the fruits of adama. In other words, it's like a little wordplay going on, telling us that while Abel brought forth, you know, the animals, he was a shepherd. What do shepherds do? They exercise dominion over the animal realm. So here comes Abel, the exerciser of dominion over the animal realm, the one manifesting the very image of Yahweh through exercising dominion. He is bringing an offering out of love, obviously choosing the best for the Lord. And he goes there in love and in joy and willingly brings this offering before the Lord, okay, exercising dominion over the animals, a shepherd. But his brother Cain comes offering up the fruits of the flesh. Do you understand the difference there? So again, we're seeing this contrast. What does Yahweh accept? The dominion. The offering of the one who exercises dominion over the animal nature. And the one who is offering up the fruit of the Adama, the source of flesh, from the lower realm, all right, that one is rejected. But he doesn't reject Cain. He goes to Cain and says to Cain, here, you can do what's right. And it says that sin is crouching at the door in the King James. But you have to realize in Hebrew, the word for sin and the word for sin sacrifice or sin offering is actually the same word. And so he's telling him, like, it's almost like he's saying, like, look, one of your brother's sheep is laying right there. Just offer that. Do what's right and you will be accepted. But he refuses to offer up the animal nature. And instead what he does is he goes out and acts like an animal in his lower nature, and he murders his brother. All right? So that's why it's rejected. Now, again, listen to what Paul writes in the letter of Galatians. He writes in chapter 5, this I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. Now, this story is played out for us between Cain and Abel, but I want you to recognize that Cain and Abel are in both of them are in us. One just represents one nature, one represents the other nature, but we're the ones with two natures. All right? So remember now, when Yeshua is standing there talking to the Samaritan woman, remember, how does he tell us to worship? In spirit and truth, in the upper realm, with pure word, truth. Not down here in the flesh fighting over rituals and customs and traditions and all that nonsense. All right? These two natures are at war. And our job is I wish I was like that girl's horse in there that could just hear the voice and instantly respond. But unfortunately for me, oftentimes the Lord needs some spurs and bridle and everything else. But we are to exercise dominion over this animal nature of ours. Now, we quickly see that Yahweh appoints another son to Adam and Hava, and that is Seth, and he replaces the murdered Abel. And he, too, seems to be a spiritual man. In some sense, within this story, we see the death and resurrection of the Messiah. If you think about it, it's pretty clear. You have Cain being the religious leaders, right? They're the serpent, if you will, that's going to bruise his heel. We have Abel being the righteous one who's humble. He's the good shepherd. But the unrighteous one kills him. But then what do we see shortly later? The righteous one's back. All right? So in some sense, in these stories, we see this beautiful story of the death and resurrection of Messiah. Now, however, let us just look at these two lines and the sons of Elohim. And as the story progresses, we get to the story again of Noah and his sons. But right before that, it tells us there's two lines. It's the line of Seth and the line of Cain. The ones are called the sons of Elohim, which Paul gives us the answer to what are the sons of Elohim. In Romans 8:14, he says, for as many as are led by the Spirit of Elohim are the sons of Elohim. In John 1:12, he says, but as many of you as receive him, gave he the power to become B'nai Elohim, the sons of Elohim. So the sons of Elohim in the book of Genesis are clearly the righteous line. But they don't make distinction. They begin to mix again. We talked about this earlier. And they begin mixing with the unrighteous line. And that's what causes the flood. That's what provokes the flood. And if you think about it, what is the flood? Where did the water come from for the flood? From above? And from below, it's measure for measure. Look, you want to mix the words? You want to mix the seed? You want to mix the natures? Here, let me mix the waters. Whoosh! And he takes it right back to what? One big giant quagmire again. We're right back at the beginning of that cycle. All right? And so then we see Noah coming out of that. And again, we see this whole mixing of the seed over and over and over again. It's as if our own flesh and the enemy wants to, if he can't curse us, then he's going to corrupt us. Do you remember, anybody remember what the doctrine of Balaam is? Right. He couldn't curse the children of Israel. Balak called him, come out and curse, come out and curse. And he couldn't do it. Right. Because he said there is no iniquity in Jacob. There's no iniquity in Israel. He's not going to curse them. And so what ends up happening is he gives the idea to Moab, look, if you can't curse them, corrupt them. And they send down the daughters and send down their women, and the women come down, and the next thing you know, the men are cohorting not only with the women of Moab, but with the Elohim of Moab. And then they find themselves covered with a plague. Again, this mixture is not good. Brothers and sisters, I have an aquarium at home. Let me see if this will help you a little bit. Every week in my aquarium, I have to change some of the water, right? Because it's not a stream, it's encased, so the water doesn't go anywhere. So the water becomes defiled. It becomes fish water, all right? It's got all kind of pollutants and stuff in there. You don't want to drink out of that, all right? So what I have to do is get the siphon hose. I suck on the hose. I drain out like 5 gallons of the water, and I dump that out, and then I go get fresh water, pure water, clean water. Now, the clean water that I put in there comes right out of the spigot. I could drink out of it. It comes right out of our well. Beautiful, clean, clear, crisp water. And so what do? I pour the fresh water into the old water. Now, it's a simple mathematics or a simple question. If I pour the pure water into the defiled water, do I get pure water? No, I get diluted, polluted, right? And I still can't drink it. So if the sons of Elohim begin mixing with the lower realm, if the upper realm begins mixing, if the two words begin mixing, do we have a pure word? No, we have a diluted, polluted word. And diluted and polluted will always lead us to death, never to life. And so again, Yahweh sought to cleanse the earth by the flood, by bringing the waters together. And he brings them all together because he says, the end of all flesh is before me. Meaning he could see what was going to happen if there is no pure word. There's no good can come of it. So before it goes too far, he stops it. He calls Noah and he brings forth again and begins making a distinction. And the story of Noah, it's wonderful because it tells us once again that he separates the water. He stops up the waters. He separates them. And the Spirit moves over creation and the dry land appears, just like at the creation story. So again, repeatedly throughout the story of the beginning of creation, we're seeing Yahweh making a distinction between the words, between the water, between the seeds. And we too are called to make that distinction. If we are going to live, we have to live in the pure water. And that's if we're going to satisfy someone's thirst, we have to bring them pure water. So that's our heart. That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to bring you pure water. We're trying to learn to make the distinctions as we study this word that's passed through time to be able to see what's been added and what's been subtracted. Where's the pollution and how do we take it out? So I got to end this teaching here for right now. We're going to continue it tomorrow and we'll pick it up again where we left off. Right now, I want to say thank you to Judith Rood, myself, and just thank her for having the courage and the boldness to be able to be called out of your comfort zone. And Judith and I work close together, and we joke as to who's going to be whose armor bearer, kind of have to support each other. We're both reluctant stars, if you will, but we just want to serve the Lord, and so we go where He calls us, regardless of where our comfort zone is. So if you would, let's get together and just bow our heads for a moment of prayer, and we're going to get into the Word of Yahweh and jump into this river of life and see where He floats us downstream. Abba, Father, once again, we just thank You for Your love, mercy, kindness, for Your graciousness, for the gift of Your Ruach HaKodesh that You pour out so liberally upon all Your children, all who would ask for the Spirit You give it. And Father, we just thank You for that guidance, for that comfort. We thank You for the precious gift of Your Word, and above all, for the precious gift of Your Son, Yeshua, our Messiah. Father, we thank You for our brothers and sisters that are here to encourage us and to lift us up, but above everything, to help us in that wonderful calling to lift up Your name and Your image in the world, that You may be glorified above all. And Father, we just thank You for this wonderful honor. In the name of Yeshua, our Messiah. Amen. All right, yesterday I left off in this teaching with the flood story, if you remember, and we talked about all the connections between the water and the Word and the nature of man, and that we saw a series of two waters, we saw two seeds, two words, and two natures of man. And I'm going to quickly run through the last piece of that flood teaching, and then we're going to move on into a little different section. But I want you to just recognize in this that pattern again that we established on Shabbat teaching, that there's this pattern that keeps happening of there being a quagmire as in creation, and then Yahweh intercedes by making divisions and distinctions, and then He moves from there and he acts and He calls out at least one man of righteousness.
Now, that should be a comfort to all of us, because what we're really seeing in that is the idea that there's always a remnant, that Yahweh is always providing a remnant for us that will protect this word. And so from generation to generation, from the creation, Yahweh has always provided servants that had a faithful heart. He's raised up men and women, a faithful heart, to carry His pure Torah, His pure word, to the people. And so there's never been a time where the pure Torah is not being taught. And for that, we just have to thank Him for His provision of righteous men and women with a faithful heart, willing to withstand the pressures of the culture around them and all the other mixture that wants to come in and destroy that word. But Yahweh is faithful in doing that. We left off with the story of Noah and the flood, and I want to talk about this for a minute. The Torah tells us very specifically that Noah was chosen to be the part of this rescuing of the image of Yahweh and the protection of the pure Torah. And that Noah was chosen, it says, because he was seen to be righteous in his generation. But Noah was married and had a wife, and they had three children, three sons. And we may ask, in a sense, like, okay, we know why Noah was chosen, but why the three sons? Why were the three sons of Noah used for this rescue operation of the earth and of the human race and of the pure Torah? And I want to suggest to you that the answer to that question is not overtly given in the Torah, but it's kind of subtly given in the names of the three sons. The names of the three sons are Shem, Ham, and Japheth, or Shem, Ham, and Japheth in Hebrew. And these names always appear in that order. Every time they're mentioned, they're always mentioned in this particular order. But one time it gets reversed. There's one exception to this rule, and we're going to just dismiss that for a moment. What I want you to see is in the names of these three sons, we talked yesterday about man being a two-part being, that he has an upper nature, a spiritual nature that relates to the Father and the Spirit of Elohim, and then he has a carnal nature or a corporal nature that gives him the ability to be the mediator and therefore relate to the creatures here on earth. But we also talked that he's a tripart being in the sense that he has a spirit, a soul, and a body. And that's the proper created order for man. For man to be man in the sense of Adam, called in the image of Yahweh, we have to live in that created order where our spirit is in communion with the spirit of the Creator who is giving us direction, revelation, knowledge. Our spirit then informs our soul how to feel, how to think, and how to look at the world around us. And then our soul reigns over our flesh. That's the proper created order. The soul tells the flesh how to interact in the world. Now, again, at the fall, that got turned around. But I want you to see in the names of the sons of Noah this particular reality. In the names of the sons, Shem, the name Shem means name. That's what his name means. His name is name. It's like, you know, Noah wasn't a very imaginative guy. He saw the birth certificate. It said name on it. And, yeah, it's good with me, you know. No, his name means name. And we see in that name, the idea of naming, from the beginning of creation, remember that Yahweh gave Adam dominion over the animal realm. And then in the second part of the creation narrative, in chapter 2, it talks about he brought all the animals, all right, before, he brought all the animals before Adam to see what they would name him, all right? And so part of the exercising of dominion is giving names. Later in Genesis 5, it tells us that Yahweh gave names. All right, you gave the names Adam to Adam and Eve. And so we see that naming has to do with dominion. So Shem, the word name, really is an exercise in some sense, is a symbol of the spirit or the spiritual man who has dominion. He's giving names. The name Ham, on the other side, is not really Ham, it's Ham. In Hebrew, it means heat. And heat, if you will, is something that comes from our passions. Throughout the Torah, there's numerous examples where they're describing someone's anger or they're describing lust. And Paul talks about, you know, it's better to marry than to burn. And he's talking about the heat of passion. They'll say sometimes that Yahweh's wrath raged or burned within him. And so we can connect heat with our emotions, and our emotions are connected with our soul. And so we're going to say that Ham represents the soul of man. Japheth, the name Japheth means open places, but it's also related to the word Yefeh, which means beauty or outward appearance. And therefore, we're going to say that Japheth is the symbol of the flesh, the outward appearance of man. So what we see in this wonderful little detail of the names of the sons of Noah constantly being given in that same order is that it's saying that Noah was righteous, and the means by which he was righteous is because he raised his sons in the right order.
In other words, they were spiritual men whose spirits reigned over their soul and their soul reigned over their flesh. All right? And that then gives us a reason why were these three sons allowed on the ark. It's because they lived their lives in proper order. They were raised by a righteous father and mother, and so they're in proper order. Now, a little later in the story, we're going to find out that one of those sons, Ham, the soul, the one that represents the soul, does something very fleshly. In other words, he's drawn down into the flesh, and because of that, there's a curse. Noah curses the line of Ham and his son Canaan in particular. And we see that later on, the descendants of Shem, who become the children of Israel, we get these prohibitions about them mingling with the sons of Canaan, all right, or the sons of Ham, which include Egypt, which is kind of interesting. In Leviticus 18:3, what we see is that after the doing, Yahweh warns the children of Israel as they're going into the land of Canaan again from Egypt. He says, after the doing of the land of Egypt, wherein you dwelt, shall you not do. And after the doings of the land of Canaan, whether I bring you, shall you not do. Neither shall you walk in their ordinances. In other words, we see in this again that the children of Israel, the descendants of Shem, are a division is being made. One more time. We see that intervention. If you think about the story of the Tower of Babel, everybody wanted to be at Shinar. Again, what was going to happen? The godly line was going to mix with the ungodly line, just like in Genesis 6, before the flood, provoking the flood. Okay, we see that again in the Tower of Babel story. And now we see that Yahweh once again wants that distinction between the godly line. In other words, he's always going to preserve that remnant that's going to be responsible for bringing us the pure Torah or the pure water. All right, there's always that remnant, and he's always making divisions. Leviticus 18:24-25, again, Yahweh warns, defile not you yourselves of any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you, and the land is defiled, where I do visit the iniquity, therefore, upon it. And the land itself vomiteth out the inhabitants. So in many sense, it's just as if, you know, they're drinking polluted water. What happens if you drink polluted water? You're going to vomit it out, right? Your body can't take it. It's going to make you sick. And so here he's saying, look, the land itself that I have chosen, this land of Torah, will only tolerate the pure Torah. It's not going to tolerate pollution and mixture. So when you get in there, don't look at what they've done because I'm vomiting them out. They've corrupted it. Their pollution. Don't jump in that defilement. We're going to purge that out. And the people that have committed, the covenant people, to doing the pure Torah, that's who will live in the land. There's a difference between the story in the book of Genesis and every other creation narrative. And the difference is this. It's a simple one. All the other stories begin with the same story that we find in the book of Genesis. All right? Every culture's creation narrative began with the truth. It all began with Adam telling Cain and Abel what happened, what he knew about from the Garden of Eden. And the story was told from there, and it was passed from generation to generation to generation. Now, a whole lot of the generation and part of the story got wiped out in the flood. And then the story continues on with Noah, who passes it on to his children, who pass it on to their children. Now, when we get to the Tower of Babel and language gets changed, now suddenly one says Elohim, one says Allah, and the names get changed, and the next thing you know, new religions form. And each culture has one. But they still have the inkling of the truth of the stories. And it goes down, and each one is changing it to accommodate their culture, to accommodate their customs, including the Hebrew version. And it's going from generation to generation. That's why we see that the father of Abraham, the Hebrew, worships idols. Sarah's family, they were idol worshipers. All right? Rebecca's family, idol worshipers. We see that this is, I mean, it's in the scriptures. It's telling us that they believed in more than one Elohim. And so here it comes, even the Hebrew story, passing through the generation, is like that river that began pure at the beginning, but from generation to generation, it's being polluted. It's picking up silt along the way. It's picking up mixture along the way. And so now it comes to the children of Israel, and it's a polluted story. Even the children of Israel, even the Hebrew story is a polluted story. Now, what are you saying? That the Bible's not true? No, absolutely not. So what makes the book of Genesis different? The book of Genesis didn't come from Adam. It came from Mount Sinai. In other words,
While all the other cultures' creation myth has been passed from generation to generation, has rolled down the mountain, picking up pollution all along the way, at Mount Sinai, Yahweh spoke this story to Moses. In other words, it didn't come from generation to generation. It came from the Creator, the only eyewitness left. And He spoke this story to Moses. So that means when we reach Mount Sinai, what do we reach? The very beginning of the river. See, that's the beauty of this story. We've seen already from the garden to the mountain, how many times did Yahweh provide protection for the water? How many times did He divide it away and provide shelter and protection for it? Now at Mount Sinai is the great corrective. All the children of Israel may have heard all these other myths and stories and legends and pollution, and it all came down to a mix, and it comes back to them. And now that they stand at Mount Sinai, Yahweh says, well, do you remember this story? And they all, you mean the one about, and He goes, okay, well, let me tell you what really happened. All right? Do you guys remember reading about this? And then He would, you mean, let me tell you what really happened. All right? It's the great corrective. I have to just indulge myself for a minute and ask you to indulge me. You know what? I have two adopted children. We adopted them when they were 8 and 10. And, when you adopt older children, I don't know how many of you may have adopted children or be adopted yourself, but when you adopt older children, they come to you with a past. And, of course, they're meeting you. You're already grown up, and you have a past. And so part of the joy of the adoption process is getting to know each other. And they don't know you, and you don't know them. And so you're always learning, trying to do it quickly, who you are. You know, who are you? What's your story? What's your past? How did you become what you are today? And the kids are asking us, and we're asking them. Well, the children that we adopted, their brother and sister, Kim and Jeremy, they're my oldest two kids, and I love them dearly. But they lived in a very small rural town, and so they had never been anywhere in their life. I mean, they've never really been in a car very long. And when we went to adopt them, where they lived in central Pennsylvania was about 2 hours from where we lived in Pittsburgh. And we live in a big city, you know. And so car rides for them were very laborious. They had never been that long. And it seemed endless to them. And especially since they had never been to where we lived, you know, once you passed like the end of the boundaries where they knew the end of the street, from there on it was an endless highway. And once it hit to be, you know, about 20 minutes of driving, they're already, you know, are we there yet? How far do you live? I mean, you live in California? You know, no, you know, we're just in Pittsburgh. I mean, we're almost there, you know. And so to entertain them, and then we would drive from Pittsburgh to Michigan with them in the car, 9-hour drive, okay. You had to entertain these kids. I mean, it was like being Moses, you know. I'm out of water. Can we get water? I'm hungry. You know, who's going to feed us? How long? I can't take it anymore, you know. She looked at me. So I mean, you know, again, you have like this, like, you know, you have this moaning behind you. And again, you're thinking of Moses and thinking of smiting something with a stick. You know, it's one of your names, Rocky, you know. So what I would do sometimes in the car, and I shouldn't probably tell myself, but what I would do sometimes, because they didn't know who we were, I'd be driving, and when I could tell they were getting edgy, you kind of needed to entertain them, you know. And so this is the other beautiful part of homeschooling and with kids and adopting, is you can tell them anything and they believe it. So I would do stuff like this. I would be driving along, and I'd say, hey, Jeremy, did I ever tell you that time that I went skydiving? And we went up, and we were flying in this plane, and we were turning a bend, and I was getting ready to jump out of the plane, and just as we did, the guy turned, and I tripped, and I fell, and I went right out of the airplane, and I couldn't find my chute, and these other guys jumped on, and they're swinging down, they're trying to catch me, but I'm bigger than them, and I'm heavier, and I'm going faster, and I would make the story up for about an hour long. I'm telling this story, you know, building it up, they're riveted to me, man, they're just listening, can't wait, it's so dramatic. And then when I'd get to the end of it, I'd say, and I never told you that? And they said, no. I said, it never happened, that's why. But at least I was an hour down the road, and they weren't talking, you know, so, yeah. But what I'm sharing with you today is truth. I'm not making this up. It's in the Bible. So if we hear all these stories like that are fantasy, that stars and moons answered prayers, and beasts of the earth rose up and did mighty works, and all these fantasies and myths and legends have been passed down through the pollution of the generations. At Mount Sinai, that never happened. And at Mount Sinai, he tells us the truth. Now, I know a whole lot of believers in my lifetime that have said, all that I want is the truth. And so you say, go to Mount Sinai. That's where the river begins. And there you will find the pure truth. Now, it's important that we understand that at Mount Sinai, Yahweh is giving the corrective. That's where it begins. So what he speaks at Mount Sinai is the truth. And the covenant that was received there, the covenant that Yahweh gives to the children of Israel, isn't just the Ten Commandments. It's the whole revelation of the Torah. And the Torah is nothing more than his self-revelation. Meaning, again, we have an invisible Elohim, correct? We can't see him, but yet he's everywhere. He's clearly here in this place. He has been clearly here in Jimmy Black and Paul Wilbur. He's clearly been here in Michael's teaching. I pray and feel that he's here with me, or I'd be shaken up here. I know he's with you because you all have been ministering to me. I see him in our staff, and just the presence of Yahweh is so clearly present in this place. But none of us can see him unless he is embodied in us. And what Judith was talking about today up here with the Lydia Project, and I know she's nervous and anxious to be up here and wants so much to convey these messages, but what a better opportunity to be a blessing and to make Yahweh known and to make Yeshua real for the people of Israel than that we put it into our flesh, that we live out his words, and that we, by our actions, demonstrate his charity, his generosity, his benevolence, his love and care for the least of all societies. What a greater way to make him seen to those who have blinders spiritually, but their physical eyes are open, so let's give it to them in a physical fashion. Let's embody it. And that's the calling of Mount Sinai. The calling on the children of Israel is this. It's the calling of Adam. If you remember when we were back in the garden where the river really began, and it was the beginning of all life, and that's where the pure water began, it began and was given and entrusted to Adam, the first water bearer. All right? And Adam was given the pure Torah in the very nature of his creation. In other words, from the beginning, we've been hotwired to keep the word. All right? That's what we were created for. I mean, pigs were not created to be bacon. They were created to be vacuum cleaners for the carpet of the earth. All right? So pigs do what pigs do. But we were created for a purpose too. And our purpose is to be the body or the image of Yahweh in the world. And the only way we can do that is to submit our flesh to our soul, who is receiving the spiritual revelation of the pure Torah. So in every commandment, in every edict, in every statute, in every ordinance that we find in the Torah, in the written Torah, every one of those is an expression of some aspect of the Creator and his heart. The Torah is telling us everything we know to know who our Elohim is. And what he is, and how we are to embody it. If we are to embody it by exercising dominion over the animal realm, if we're to make it manifest, then we have to look at, well, how does the Creator interact with his creation? And he does so by revealing his holiness. He does so by revealing to us in the statutes about justice that he treats his creatures justly. In the statutes that command us to show mercy and compassion and care for the poor and the least, he demonstrates that he loves even the least, even the smallest bird that falls from the sky. He knows about it and cares. And the way we are even called to treat our enemies, he shows us that we are to exert that he does not delight in the death of sinners, and therefore neither should we rejoice in the death of our enemy. Right? So everything that's revealed to us in the feasts, and the sacrifices, and the ordinances about justice, and the purity laws, and the laws about separation, and nidah, all those things are revelations about who he is. And that's the calling on the children of Israel Earlier, and I'm so this shows you how much the Lord is in this place. Michael and I originally Saturday morning were supposed to get up and do a midrash together, and we talked. And Michael said, "Well, you know, we need to do something with Shavuot," and so we decided that I would do the teaching on the wedding at Mount Sinai, and show how the whole story of Exodus. And if you've never seen this, I have a teaching back there called The Wedding of Sinai. You need to listen to it if you've not seen this. And it's one that I wrote. With the idea in mind that we can give this to our brethren in the Christian church that still think we're under the law and don't get what we're doing. Because what it shows is that the entire book of Exodus is really this very, very, very romantic love story. All right, and it shows Yahweh actually wooing his beloved, which is kind of sweet. You know, he gets sweet on her and talks to her tenderly. You know, then he wants to be a little macho. He makes her a bunch of promises to impress her. You know, look what I can do for you. You know, and so then there's an engagement goes on, and he actually gets engaged. You know, and then he gets down on his knee, proposes, and all that's in the book of Exodus. I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's just gorgeous. And then he takes him to the mountain. And at the mountain is where they enter the chuppah. Now, where I say how come Yahweh's in this place is because of the changes in our schedule due to the gift of being on television, being able to reach the nations, we weren't able to do that. So what does Paul Wilbur get up and talk about? Shavuot, the marriage, the covenant, all the stuff that I was going to say, he said it beautifully. So, I mean, it was like Yahweh had a heart to get that message to you, and he didn't care which servant did it, but it got here. And that's how I know Yahweh's in this place this weekend. It's been great. But I want you to understand what the calling is at the mountain. Yahweh brings his children to the mountain, and he's asked them, do you want to be segula to me? Do you want to be a treasure so precious that I will never entrust you to anyone else? I mean, think about that. Remember in the Gospels where Yeshua says that? You know, that no one can pluck you from the hand of the Father. No one can pluck you from my hand. Do you know what he's talking about now? Exodus 19, do you want to be segula? Well, he tells us then, how do we get to be that? When Yeshua says, you know, no one can pluck you from my hand. It's because you're segula. You are a treasure so precious to the Creator that he won't let anyone take you from his hand. He is not going to entrust your souls with anybody but him. All right? That's awesome. I mean, brothers and sisters, if you didn't feel love before this, I mean, feel love now. I mean, just go ahead and hug yourself or something. I mean, because you are loved. You are a precious treasure. Now, the question is, okay, I'm not really feeling that, so, like, how do I become that? Well, at Mount Sinai in Exodus 19, he says this, if you will hearken to my voice and keep my commandments, you will be to me a precious treasure. All right? Now, why is that? Why is it that we will be so special to him if we just hearken to his voice and keep his commandment? And let me explain it this way. It tells us from the very beginning of the scriptures to the end that the Creator is a loving Creator. Yahweh loves all. In fact, John wrote in the Epistle to John, Elohim, God, is love. Meaning that's his nature. He can't even help himself. He has to love everything because it's his nature, all right? That he's pure love. And in him there is no hatred. He's just pure love. I mean, that's his very nature. Yahweh is love. And so he loves. And he loves his whole creation. He loves it enough that he sent his own son to take on the sins of the world and to die so that all who would believe in him could have eternal life. He loves the whole world. He gave him for the sake of the world. Not just for the sake of you and I, not just for the sake of the people of Israel, but for the entire creation. So Yahweh's, the scope, if you will, of the Creator's love is for the entire creation. It is not just for you and me. It is specifically us, but it is not just for us. It's for the entire world. And because of that love for the... Okay, let me just stop right here, take a little breather. How many of you... I'll put this way back in your past. Well, some of you not so far back because you're young, but for me, it's way back in my past. How many of you, when you were in junior high school, like fell in love with like some girl in algebra class or some boy in biology class? And I mean, you were just smitten, all right? And they never knew you existed, right? That happened to you? Never happened to me. All right. Too many times. Try to block those memories out. All right. Do you remember that feeling? Do you remember the hurt, the depth of that hurt? I mean, when just inside you, all you wanted to do was breathe the same air they breathed, you know? You would love nothing more. I mean, okay, I mean, I hate revealing myself up here. I feel like I'm naked. Listen, I remember asking for a hall pass at the end of the class and saying I desperately needed to go see the nurse just so I could be in the hall when the bell rang by the door next to me because the girl I liked was in the other classroom. All right? She had no clue who I was. I just wanted to see her come out the door. All right? I mean, I was like manipulating. And just to be next to this person for a moment was like, to me, you know, and I could get through the rest of the day. All right? But by the time I got home, you know, I'm heartbroken, you know, and I could show you journals, you know, like of my early faith life. Oh, please, Lord, help her to see me. You know, give me a way to know. Please, you know, make the substitute teacher change our chair so I can be right next to her. You know, please, Lord, let me be adopted so my name gets changed and I can move up. You know, I mean, anything. You know, it's youth. It's youth. You learn. All right. But I want you to feel that heartache that you have, you know, when that happens, the unrequited love. Okay, now multiply that by, what's the size of the population of the earth? What is it? Say it louder. 6 billion? Okay, multiply that pain by 6 billion. The Creator loves 6 billion people, and most of it is unrequited love. Whew. Well, I only did it one at a time, and it overwhelmed me. So how do we, why is he asking us to become Segula to him? Why is he making, if he loves everybody, why is he making us this offer to become something more than that? Well, it's this. Because the favor he is asking of us is to reach 6 billion people with his love. Because the burden he carries in his heart for the universe is beyond our imagination. So he calls us as the children of Israel, and he says to us this, come to the mountain, and I want to marry you. Because in marriage, what was Eve's purpose? To be a helpmate to her husband? But it also says this, that when a man marries a woman, the two shall become one, and she shall be bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. Remember back in the garden? Adam's put to sleep. Yahweh takes a rib from his side, creates Eve. Adam wakes up. What's he say? Wow. All right. Now I'll be able to find my socks. That's why they were naked at first, because there was no woman there to keep track of the laundry, and so they had to be naked. And so he had, the Lord said, enough of this, I'm walking around naked in my garden. I've got to make you a wife that can find your socks. Jeez. All right. She's to be a helpmate, but she is to be more than that. She's to be bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. In other words, she is going to be his embodiment. That picture there is why we call it holy matrimony. A couple months back, I got the great privilege and honor. Michael's daughter, Sarah, and her husband, Benjamin, blessed me with the request of performing their wedding. And it was just an absolute honor and joy to do that. And that's what we talked about there, how it used to be called. Used to be called, hardly anybody says it, oh, that's archaic language, a holy estate of matrimony. Do you understand that? When we get married, it's a holy thing. Why is it so holy? Because it's a picture of the Creator and his love for his people. And that's when we get married. That's what we're called to do. We're called in our marriages to be bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. So that's the embodiment part. And that's what Yahweh's doing at Mount Sinai. There's this beautiful wedding, and he's asking Israel, will you become my Eve? Will you be not my bride, but my wife? Will you become one with me? Will you allow me to fill you and become truly one in heart and soul? And will you be my bone and flesh in the world? That's what Israel's being asked. And she responds back by saying, everything you say, I will do. I mean, how could you turn down that offer? You know, all the love and tenderness he showed, he's brought them, he delivered them from bondage, he washed her clean, he, you know, established her and promised her to become a nation and give her a land of her own. I'll build you a nice house, white picket fence, nice boundaries, you know, Jordan River. Okay, he's going to give her the beautiful land. How could she turn it down? And so she says, yes, all that you say, we will do. Now, I want you to hear this very carefully. Notice when he got engaged to her, the engagement is when he gets down on his knees and he says to the bride, he says, will you be segula to me if you keep my covenant, if you will heed my word? Heed my word. Hear my voice. And if you will do that and obey what you hear, then you'll be segula to me. And then he gives her the Torah. Now, what we're being asked to do there is this. Will you commit your life, spirit, soul, and body, to living by my exclusive word? It's the call of Adam. Be my image. Because if we live by his exclusive word, then we begin embodying his character, his nature, his invisible traits become visible in us. Right? We become the living image of Yahweh in the world. Where are people going to come to Messiah? In us. We are called to be the body of Messiah. Where are people going to come to understand Yahweh, that he's not this horrendous God of law and judgment and punishment and death and destruction? In us, when we start embodying his teachings about righteousness and holiness and compassion and justice and love and mercy and charity and generosity, that's when they're going to see it. And it's not going to take just one of us. It takes all of us. Where once it was embodied in one man, now there's 6 billion people. One man can't possibly do it. Not even with all the technology we have to go around the world on satellite. It takes all of us to do it. We have to be a body. And so now, where once Yahweh called a man to be his image, now he calls a people to be his image. And so the children of Israel, I'm going to suggest to you, are the first multi-membered body of Messiah. And the request that's given to them is that they will live by the exclusive word of Yahweh. In other words, they're not going to live by the word that's been passed down from generation to generation to generation to generation and picked up all this pollution. He made the corrective at Mount Sinai, and he's telling them his pure word right there. Will you live by the pure word? Are you ready to do that? Are you ready to give up all the idols? Are you ready to put away all the religious systems? Are you ready to dismiss the fruit that you've been eating from of the tree of knowledge and good and evil? Are you ready to take your flesh voice, your word, and take it to the cross? Are you ready to put your word to silence? Remember way back I talked about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he said that, you know, we only have one mouth, so for one word to be spoken, the other one has to be silent. Well, we only have one body, and to embody one word, we can't do both. And so are we willing to give up all of that, to be his segula, and to live by his exclusive word? That's what's being asked of the children of Israel at Mount Sinai. And the children of Israel, and this, if you want to, there's a lot of debate, you know, well, who are the children of Israel? You know, who are the Jews? Who are the children of Israel? Oh, they're the biological descendants. No. The Torah defines it right here. Who are the children of Israel? They're the ones that are willing to live by the exclusive word of Yahweh. That's Israel. That's the definition that's given to us at Mount Sinai. Israel, the chosen, the segula in his hand, are those that heed his voice. All right? So what happens? Well, when we get to Mount Sinai, this is what happens. The children of Israel say yes, but they hear the voice of the Lord, and they say to Moses, no more. They're terrified. When he reveals himself to them, the grandness of his glory and the awesomeness of his presence is a terror to man. And their sensual beings trembled and quaked, and the mountain shook, and they feared for their lives. Were they just in doing that? Absolutely. And you know what? When we stand before the cross, doesn't our flesh tremble and shake? They were being asked to put their flesh to death and to live by the exclusive word of Yahweh. They had right to tremble in fear. It was an ominous task they were being asked to accept. And though they said yes with their mouth, when it became reality, they realized how terrifying it really is and how awesome it is. And so they trembled and quaked, and they said, Moses, you go up, and we'll stay down here, and we'll listen what you have to say. And so Moses, being faithful, goes back up the mountain. He receives the rest of the revelation. He writes it down. He comes down, and he brings it to the children of Israel, and they receive the pure Torah. Now, let me just take a sidetrack here, a little rabbit trail, because I want to get this out. Again, talking about being under the law, just like the bitter waters, I want to show you this picture that exists here right now. And that is that Moses is up on Mount Sinai, and when he's up on Mount Sinai receiving the revelation, the children are down below listening to their flesh. All right? The sensual part of nature of the children of Israel is rising up because Moses, their sensual, physical, viewable, tangible leader, the embodiment of Yahweh for them at the moment as the great deliverer is embodied in Moses, he's not there. They can't see him. He's up in this, like, you know, volcano that's erupting on the top of Mount Sinai, and this guy's up there 40 days and 13 seconds, and he ain't coming back. All right? And because their sensual eyes can't see through the glory of Yahweh and see Moses sitting there receiving this in perfect peace and rapture and joy, exaltation, they can't see that. They begin to get a little antsy. I think God ate him. I don't think he's coming back. You know, what are we going to do? We can't just stay here in the middle of the wilderness without Moses. We've got to have a God to lead us. Well, somebody gets the bright idea. Let's make a picture of God. And there's a whole other teaching on this I can't get into now. When the Torah portion comes up, you follow along, you'll get it. But they make an idol. They make a golden calf. And they start having a feast to Yahweh with a golden calf in front of them. Now, to their credit, remember that only Moses had heard the rest of the Torah at this point, not them. He's still up there getting the revelation. So they're doing the best they can, but notice that what they're doing is very sensual. They're making an image for themselves so they can have an object to worship because they can't see the invisible Elohim. He has to be embodied in something. So let's embody him in a piece of gold and make a big cow, all right? And so that's what they do. Moses comes down the mountain. He's got the tablets of Yahweh in his hand that Yahweh had carved out, two stone tablets, wrote the Ten Commandments on them, gives them to Moses. Moses tells Moses, Moses, I think you need to get downstairs. So Moses climbs down this mountain, and he sees what the people are doing. He takes the two tablets that Yahweh had carved out of the mountain and had written on with his own finger. He takes them, and he throws them down, and they shatter into a million pieces. And the people looked up and said, "Ho, we didn't think you were coming back." And Moses is furious with them. And so this whole thing with the ritual, the grinding up of the gold and them drinking it, and takes place. And so the people fall on their faces because they realize they've broken the very covenant they just made with Yahweh. And they're repentant and they know there's a consequence. And they fall before their face and they weep. And the next thing, Yahweh shows them mercy and he invites Moses. He says, come back up the mountain. This time you carve out the tablets and bring them with you. And so he climbs up the mountain carrying two stone tablets, and Yahweh says, I will write on them the same thing I wrote on the first two tablets. Right? So Moses comes back up and he writes the two tablets. Now, let me just explain what that's all about. The children of Israel at Mount Sinai received the Torah. But did they keep the Torah? No. They didn't keep it pure. Here's what happens. Moses comes down the mountain with the original Torah and he teaches the Torah, but he tells it to Aaron. Aaron tells it to Joshua. Joshua tells it to the 120 elders. The 120 elders tell it to the children of Israel. Now, there's a thing in there that says, okay, I want you to make a burnt offering. And so Aaron says, okay, we've got every day, we've got to make a burnt offering, morning and evening. It's called the Tamid offering. It's a continual offering. And every day, morning and evening, we're going to sacrifice a lamb in the morning. We're going to sacrifice a lamb in the evening. So they build an altar, and the instructions are very specific on how to build the altar. But where are the instructions for how to sacrifice the lamb? There are none. So Aaron's got the lamb, and he knows they're supposed to make a sacrifice, but there's no real instructions on how are we supposed to do it. I mean, do we do it? Do we chop off his head with an axe? You know, do we use a pocket knife, a Swiss Army knife? You know, how are we supposed to do this? Do you hit him with a car? You know, I mean, what happens? How do we kill this lamb? We got this lamb. We know we've got to sacrifice, but there's no instructions. So, you know, Aaron figures it out. Well, this is what we do normally, so let's do this. We've got to collect the blood, so let's cut his jugular vein. Let's collect the blood. We're going to put it in the bowl. We're going to offer the blood on the altar, and this is how you do it. So Aaron develops a pattern of doing it. We have great freedom here because Yahweh doesn't box us into every little tiny detail. He gives the children of Israel phenomenal flexibility. And so Aaron develops a pattern of sacrificing. It's very efficient. It seems to work. Okay, we got it. So he teaches his sons. His sons teach their sons. And all the Kohanim learn how to do it. And they all do it like Aaron. Is it a commandment to do it that way? No. It's just a practical way of doing things. Tzitzi, another, the fringes that we wear on our garments. All right? I've been watching. Man, there's some creativity in tying here. All right? And that's wonderful. I love that. I'd like to see diverse tzitzi. I like to see that people are wearing them, that men and women are wearing them. They're faithful to the commandment. The commandment says men and women are to wear, put fringes, the children of Israel put fringes on the corners of their garments, all right, with a thread of blue in it. So what's the commandment? Put fringes on the corner of your garment with a thread of blue. What about the other color? Doesn't have to be another color, does there? Doesn't say. Now, tradition has it being blue and white, but that's a tradition. It's not a commandment. How long should they be? Doesn't say. Make them as long or short as you want. Just put them on there. All right. Well, how many strings should be in it? Doesn't say. Put as many strings or as few as you like. You know, it says it has to have a string of blue, but go ahead. Yahweh gives us so much freedom in the Torah, it's unbelievable. And so we are free to fulfill his commandments in numerous fashions. So what ends up happening is patterns develop among different groups and different peoples. Now, when the first generation develops a method of slaughtering or a method of tying the tzitzi, and they teach it to the next generation is receiving the pure water, all right? They've received the pure water, the actual commandment to put fringes on the corner of their garments, and they receive the tradition of how to tie them if you, you know, learn from me. The next generation, and they make a distinction. This is the commandment. This is how we do it. The next generation, though, may receive it as it's already mixed together. In other words, we're supposed to put tzitzi on our garment or fringes on our garment that are tied this way. All right? And little by little, over time, as that commandment gets passed down, some of these traditions get mixed in. And the next thing you know, people are reading the word and thinking that these traditions are part of the commandment. And we're right back down to mixture. So even this pure Torah from Mount Sinai, as it's been passed down, it got caught up with traditions, and it passes all the way down with traditions. And so by the time we move downriver further in time and history, what do we see? We see a whole religion. We see this thing called, for us, Messianics. When we come out, those of us who have come out of the church, especially, we come out of the church and you know, for most of the people I know that come out, they come out of the church and they're saying, oh, you know, we watched Michael Rood's pagan Christian connection. And man, I couldn't believe that this is where we got, you know, these customs from. And I can't believe what this Christmas tree represented. I'm so embarrassed. And, you know, this is awful. And all these pagan traditions. And I didn't even know they were pagan. You know, I thought, you know, they were in the Bible. I thought we were doing this. I didn't know Easter was, you know, a fertility goddess. I don't want to be a part of that. You know, I didn't know that dyed eggs come from dipping eggs in the blood of infants. I didn't know that. I don't want that on my table. This is awful. So they leave the church and they say, this is horrible. The church is a bunch of pagans. They're all living by traditions and they polluted the water. And so now we're going to keep the Torah. But who keeps the Torah? The Jews. We're going to do what the Jews do. So they run right over to Judaism and they embrace Judaism and they put on their little kippahs and they put on their tallits and they put the mezuzah on the wall and they put their little boxes on their head and on their arms and they learn all the prayers and they bow and they daven and da-da-da-da-da. They pick up these wonderful hanukkahs with nine branches and they embrace this whole thing. And then they begin Torah study and they say, what the heck am I doing? You know, I just jumped out of the fire, or the frying pan, right into the fire. I mean, I'm drinking more polluted water here than I was over there. This is polluted water. So what is it? It's this thing called the oral Torah. Or again, as I say, in Ireland we call, you know, Torah, Laura, Laura. I mean, it's just that. You know, it's Torah lore, meaning it's stories that have been passed down. But in rabbinic Judaism, Pharisaic Judaism, they teach that there are two Torahs. One is the written Torah that Yahweh or Moses went up and Yahweh imparted it to Moses and he wrote it down. But then he went back up a second time and he told him all the details. And Moses had writer's cramp and couldn't write it down. So he just came down and told Aaron. And Aaron just told his son. And it's been told from generation to generation to generation to generation to generation. It's been told. But they teach that it has the same authority as the written Torah. I'm going to tell you very boldly, and I apologize if I offend anybody, that's a myth. That is mixture. All right? And a lot of what we have seen in the early days of the Messianic Hebrew Roots movement is this swimming from this polluted river to this polluted river and going right through the pure on the way and not even recognizing it. So we have to come to understanding. It's time for us to mature up, if you will, and to understand that the calling of Yahweh is not for us to embody man's traditions. The purpose for us is to embody the revelation of Yahweh. Now, we all have tradition. I'm not raining on your parade of traditions. We all have traditions. It's what gives us some of our identity. But if you notice, Michael has always in his ministry been very careful not to do anything the same way twice. All right? Which sometimes drives our staff crazy. But that's, you know, the beauty of that is where people will call and they'll say, well, how do we do this? And Michael says, well, you know, this year we did it this way. Last year we did it that way. A year before that we did this. You know, there's always a variety because Yahweh gives us great freedom to do what we want to do. And we can make traditions. But if those traditions begin to conflict or contradict or alter the image of Yahweh as revealed in His pure word, those traditions have to go. Now, this river that rose down or came down from Mount Sinai, remember, this is the corrective. There was a remnant, a little rivulet, if you will, of pure Torah that continues on. As this river got polluted by religious systems developing around the priesthood, around the Pharisees, I mean, on and on and on till Yeshua's time. Remember that river went down, okay? That river went into exile. That river went into the Assyrian exile and was scattered to the ends of the earth. So we see this word getting mixed and polluted. I mean, that's part of where Christianity comes from. All right? It's all these pagan traditions. How did they get in here? If it began with the Word of God, how did it get in here? Because we got scattered to the ends of the earth. And we began drinking of other waters. We carved out for ourselves cisterns. Remember that broke? That's what Yahweh said in Jeremiah? We carved out broken cisterns that wouldn't even hold water. And we refused Him the wellspring of living water. So we began mixing the water with these pagan practices. The Torah forbids that. He said, do not add to my word. I mean, He's given us pure water. He doesn't want it to become iced tea. All right? He's not making a frappuccino. All right? It's to be pure water. He makes us that same invitation. He calls the rest of Israel to come drink of me on the last great day of the Feast of Sukkot. It's Yeshua who cries out when they're doing the water rituals. It's Yeshua and they're praying for rain, for the later rain, for the harvest. It's Yeshua who cries out and says, all you who thirst, come to me and drink, and wellsprings of living water will flow from your stomachs. He is the great corrective. He's the other Mount Sinai. He is bringing us the word. He said, I don't speak what I speak. I only speak what I hear my Father say. I'm only bringing you the water from the source. I'm not mixing anything with it. These aren't my words. For all my Christian brethren that always are saying, like, well, you know, Yeshua says, keep my commandments, but he meant his commandments. No, the same Yeshua a little earlier in the chapter said, these words are not my own. They're the Father's. He doesn't teach his own word. He teaches the Father's word. So it's the commandments he's speaking of. And that's the pure river he brings us. And he's constantly showing that there's a difference. When he's tempted in the wilderness, the tempter comes to him and shows him all these things. And three times he responds with the words, it is written. Not the Talmud says or the rabbi say or in the name of Rabbi so-and-so who spoke in the name of Rabbi so-and-so who spoke in the name of Rabbi so-and-so. It is written. It is the pure word. In the Sermon on the Mount, he turns around and he says, and you have heard it said. It is written, or you have heard it said. And then he corrects it. But I say to you, And when he says, I say to you, remember, he is coming not in his own name, but in the name of Yahweh. In other words, he's not coming with his own words. He's coming with the word of Yahweh. And so on that Sermon on the Mount, just as Moses stood on the Mount and poured out the pure water upon the children of Israel in the Sinai wilderness, so now Yeshua stands on the Mount in Jerusalem, in Israel, and pours out the pure water upon the children. He brings us the life-giving waters, and he gives us that same chance. And so I'm going to suggest to you today that the whole purpose of our calling right now, that this awesome move of the Holy Spirit that began this movement, is to bring us out of bondage. In Matthew 23, Yeshua is rebuking the Pharisees, and he makes that comparison. He said, oh, you know, you Pharisees who sit in the seat of Moses, you know, but you don't do anything you say that Moses said. You know, you pile heavy burdens to be borne. Your yoke is heavy. And you put it on men's shoulders, and you won't lift a finger to help them carry it. The burden he is talking about is the burden of the oral Torah that crushes these people. They can't even put their shoes on without violating the Torah. They have a certain way you have to do it, certain patterns. As so many laws have been added that it's impossible now to keep the Torah according to the oral Torah. There's so much mixture there, all the life has been taken out of it. And Yeshua comes to set them free. He says, no, take my yoke upon you, because my burden is easy and my yoke is light. Why is it light? Because it's rabbinic free. All the billions of man-made laws that have been mixed in it, all the pagan laws of Christianity, all the pagan laws of Judaism have been removed, and it is pure Torah. His yoke is pure Torah. And if you love him, you will take that yoke upon your flesh. And you will tame your flesh to submit to your soul. And your soul will submit to your spirit. And your spirit will submit to the living revelation of Yahweh Elohim as he speaks to you. And I assure you, he says, you are weary, you will find rest in me. Brothers and sisters, if you will dare to come out of all the religious systems of men and you begin to drink of that river of life, I assure you, you will find revival for your soul. That's the invitation. We have been asked to come and to drink of the living waters. We have been asked to drink of the pure waters.